Hi, this is Alan Chartok, here today with Dr. Richard Horowitz to talk about Lyme disease. A board-certified internist in private practice in Hyde Park, New York, Dr. Horowitz is medical director of the Hudson Valley Healing Arts Center, an integrative medical center which combines both classical and complementary approaches in the treatment of Lyme disease and other tick-borne disorders. He's treated over 12,000 chronic Lyme disease patients in the last 27 years, with patients coming from all over the U.S., Canada, and Europe to his clinic. He is former assistant director of medicine of Vassar Brothers Hospital in Poughkeepsie, New York, and is one of the founding members and past president-elect of ILAD, the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society. He is also past president of the ILADEF, the International Lyme and Associated Disease Educational Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the education of healthcare professionals on tick-borne diseases. Dr. Horowitz has presented at numerous local, national, and international scientific conferences on Lyme disease and has published on the role of co-infections and toxins in Lyme borreliosis. He was awarded the Humanitarian of the Year Award by the Turn the Corner Foundation for his treatment of Lyme disease and has dedicated his life to helping those stricken with this devastating illness. His book, Why Can't I Get Better? Solving the Mystery of Lyme and Chronic Disease, was published through St. Martin's Press this past November 2013 and was on the New York Times Science bestseller list within the first month of its release. It explains his full classical and integrative approach to helping those stricken with tick-borne diseases and resistant chronic illness. You can find out more at www.cangetbetter.com or at Dr. Richard Horowitz on Facebook. We'll talk to Dr. Richard Horowitz about all of this and much more. But first, welcome, Dr. Horowitz. Thanks for coming back to see us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Alan. Great to be here.
There is nothing that I hear about more when I travel around than people who have contracted Lyme disease. So I guess the first question I want to ask you is, has it always been around, or is this something that really is new?
No, actually, Lyme has been around for quite a long time. Even in Otzi, the Neanderthal man, 5,000 years ago, they discovered the DNA of Borrelia, the organism that causes Lyme, in the Neanderthal man. So it's been around for a very long time. It's been in Europe, known about since the 1800s. I think what's different at this point is the fact that it's been spreading. There are other strains and species of Borrelia that have started to make an appearance. There are co-infections, other bacteria, viruses, and parasites now in the ticks. And I think that's the reason that people are getting so sick is from all these different strains of Lyme and co-infections. It's not just the Lyme itself.
Let's start at the beginning. How do you get Lyme disease?
Well, first, you get it from the bite of an infected tick. Usually, these are adult female ticks, although you can get it from nymphs, which are smaller ticks. And even now, they're finding the larvae. The ticks have three different life cycles. The eggs produce larvae, which then become nymphs, which you'll get in the springtime. So about now, you would expect to start seeing some larvae coming out in April and May. And the adults are later on in the year. So the tick has to be infected, and normally it has to feed off of a blood meal, such as a mouse or a deer, to be able to get it. But there are new strains now of Lyme disease. One of them is called Borrelia miyamotoi, and it's a Lyme-like illness. It's a relapsing fever spirochete. And the ticks are now transmitting this, the mother tick, directly into the larvae. So even though normally a tick would have to get it from a blood meal, these other strains of Lyme disease are now showing up and can be transmitted much more effectively from the mother tick into the eggs, into the nymphs. And I think we're going to be seeing a spreading epidemic of that in the next couple of years.
Help us with this concept of a blood meal. What do you mean?
It means the tick basically is feeding off of a mouse or a deer to get the spirochetes. They're not normally born with these spirochetes inside of the tick.
So let me just get this straight. So the disease is coming from the deer or the mouse. Is that right?
Right. In other words, it's picking it up from feeding, from having a blood meal. That's how the ticks feed. They get blood from animal hosts. And it's also found in foxes and rabbits and raccoons. It's not just in deer and mice.
So when it jumps from them onto the grass, and Alan is gardening out there, then what happens? It gets on to me. Does that mean I'm going to get Lyme disease?
No, not necessarily. It depends on how long the tick has been attached, whether the tick actually is infected. They did studies in the Hudson Valley years ago and found that approximately 70% of the ticks in the Hudson Valley have Lyme disease, and also other tick-borne infections, anaplasma, Ehrlichia, Babesia, the Powassan virus, Borrelia miyamotoi. In other words, you can get with one tick bite multiple infections at the same point in time, which would explain in part why many of these people are remaining ill.
I'm old now. I'm 72. When I was 12, I was on Fire Island, and I thought I had some kind of a bump on the back of my neck. Well, that bump was there all summer long. And at the end of the summer, I started fiddling with it and pulling this bump, whatever it was, away from my head. And I freaked out when one day the whole thing came loose and it was a tick. How come I didn't get Lyme disease?
Well, probably that tick was not infected at that point with Lyme. And again,
a long time ago.
Yeah, and again, 40, 50 years ago, I don't think the number of ticks infected was what we're seeing right now. We're definitely seeing an increase in the number of ticks that are now infected with these different species. For example, in Vermont, I testified last year at the front of the Vermont Congress, and they've been seeing, for example, in the dogs, it went from 10 to 16% of the dogs in Vermont have Lyme disease. Anaplasma, another tick-borne infection, doubled. The Powassan virus in New York State, which can be deadly in 10, 15%, even up to 30% of cases, it's gone from 1 to 2% to up to 5 to 6% just within the last couple of years.
So let me stop you. When Murray the pup, our dog, was just a little tiny dog, a puppy, we brought him to the vet who gave him some tests and tested him for Lyme disease. And guess what? He was positive for the virus, I guess. But the vet said to us, this doesn't mean he has the disease. What's the distinction?
Well, you can get an antibody response that you've been exposed.
Yes.
And in certain people and in animals, it's possible the immune system handles it. But most of the time, if you have a positive test, you've been exposed. But that doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be very ill. So, for example, in dogs, they can get Bell's palsy, just like adults do. They become lame, where they can't walk, with arthritis.
Bell's palsy is an outcome of Lyme disease sometimes?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So you can get a facial paralysis, and the dogs will get it also. So, in fact, you know, man's best friend sometimes tells us that the area you're living in is infected with the Lyme disease bacteria because the dogs will get it.
When the dogs get it and come into the house, jump on the bed... Is this a dangerous thing?
Well, I mean, it's part of the reason I'm a tremendous dog lover, and it's actually the reason I don't have a dog at this point, is because where I'm living in Hyde Park is so endemic for Lyme disease that, yes, I mean, you can bring ticks into the house from the animals, so you do have to be careful with it.
Yeah. Is the answer, Doc, that you should never garden? I mean, I hate to say this, but either that, I see people going out there, you know, they're covered up, they have double socks on and they do all this, but why tempt the fates?
Well, I mean, I think it's silly to think you're not going to enjoy the beautiful Hudson Valley, get outside,
hike. Or the Berkshires in my
case. Or the Berkshires, yeah. Of course. I think people need to go outside, but you need to do proper prevention strategies like do tick checks when you come inside. You can spray a product called permethrin. They sell it in the hardware stores.
Permethrin?
Permethrin sprays. Right. There's a name called Duranon and it repels ticks. You put it on your clothes. You take the clothes outside. You spray your clothes and it will repel the ticks. And even in heavily endemic areas, even DEET, even putting on sprays like DEET to repel the ticks.
Won't the DEET kill you?
Well, I'm careful with it. I mean, there are different strengths of it. But if you're going to be a highly endemic area, sometimes you may want to put DEET on and wash it off.
Let me test you a little bit here. I know all those things you just said, they're great. But I know that if I just work on my columns and whatever I'm writing and don't go out in the garden, which I love to do, I'm not going to get the ticks. But I know that no matter what I do, if I go out and start working in the garden, then I have a chance of getting the tick, right? So ipso facto, the answer is don't go in the garden if you want to really avoid Lyme disease.
Well, I mean, people have to make that decision on their own as far as how much, because I love gardening too and get out there quite a bit.
Yeah.
But what we do is we have a company, New York Tick Control. They come and they spray a product that kills the adults and the nymphs.
Spray where? In the garden?
They spray the gardens. They spray around the property. And they put even bait boxes down that when the mice go in there to eat the oats that are in these bait boxes, the permethrin will kill the ticks on top of the mice. So years
ago... The mice.
No, not the mice. And they're even now looking at vaccines for the mice so that the mice itself will be immunized and kill off the spirochetal infections. So the mice won't carry it. So they're even looking at that as a prevention strategy.
Right. And are these kinds of companies around for everybody?
Yes. I mean, they have them in New York, across the United States. They have tick control companies. And this is something, you know, I'm an environmentalist. I'm very careful with chemicals. But in some cases, I think Ultra Tempo, which is what they spray, it does not get into the groundwater. It has about a week half-life. And so I have a pond. I have to be careful with the fish. But so far, nothing's happened. And we have not found ticks in us in the last couple of years using these type of companies.
Do ticks get into water?
I don't think they're commonly in water. Usually they're hanging about the edges of your property. They don't like direct sun because they dry up. They need a moist environment. So it'd be surprised in water because they like moisture, but I don't think in water they would survive.
Now, there are such things as beetle traps. You can get these traps and you put them on the, around your tomato plants or whatever, and the beetles come and they go into the trap. Is there such thing as a tick trap?
Well, it's kind of these traps that I was discussing is more for the mice to try and kill. Yeah, to try and kill off the ticks in the back of the mice. And I think if you're living in a highly endemic area, it's something you may want to consider.
It's all endemic now, isn't it?
Well, it is, especially in the Northeast. I mean, yeah. California, the Pacific, and it's spreading across the United States. I mean, even when I was in Europe, when I travel in Europe and lecture, it's across France and Europe. China told me when I lectured for the government in China, they told me 6% of the people in China had it. Of 1.2 billion people, you're talking millions and millions of people who have Lyme across the world right now.
So now what are the manifestations of the disease? How do you know you got it?
Well, Lyme is a multisystemic illness. So the thing is that it's not just about getting tired or getting a headache or getting joint pain or having memory problems. What it is it's a constellation of symptoms. So for example, if you have the following symptoms, you have good and bad days, where some days you feel quite well and some days you feel quite poorly. And you have migratory muscle or joint pain that moves around your body. One day it's in your shoulder, 2 days later it's in your knees, 3 days later it's in your ankles. It moves around. Migratory muscle and joint pain, that's the hallmark of Lyme disease. Same thing with migratory nerve pain called neuralgia, where you have burning, tingling, or numbness in different parts of your body that comes and goes.
Now, why does it move around?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I've never seen in the literature an explanation as to why it migrates. It's just it's one of the classical manifestations. So, you know, it's one thing if you get arthritis. You get older, you might get arthritis in your neck or your shoulder, but it usually doesn't move around the body. So if you have good and bad days where the symptoms come and go, and you're tired, and you have a stiff neck and a headache, light sensitive, you're sound sensitive, you're dizzy, your memory and concentration isn't working well, you're forgetting names and phone numbers, you walk into a room and you can't remember why you walked in.
Oh my God, I think I have Lyme disease. Just kidding. Go ahead.
You can't fall asleep at night. You keep waking up in the middle of the night. You're anxious and depressed and you have no reason why. You might have chest pain and shortness of breath and your cardiologist can't figure it out. It's this constellation of symptoms. It's a multisystemic illness. So it doesn't mean if you're tired, you have Lyme. But if you're tired with migratory muscle and joint pain, with migratory nerve pain, tingling, numbness, burning that comes and goes, memory concentration problems where you've gone to the doctor and they've ruled you out for B12 deficiency and folic acid deficiency and your thyroids are fine. They can't find a reason why your memory's not working and you're relatively young and you can't fall asleep. And again, they look for reasons. You don't have sleep apnea. You're not drinking too much coffee. You know, the whole idea is to look for the causes of these symptoms. But if your doctor can't find the causes and you have a multisystemic illness, then there's a possibility of Lyme and then you need to do the blood test. But the problem is, the blood tests are just not reliable. The ELISA test, which is the first test that doctors are taught to do, only picks it up in about 50% of the people. And doctors are taught, unfortunately, that if this test is negative, don't do a Western blot. Don't do the next test in the series. But here's the problem. Even with Lyme, the Western blots, there are 100 different strains of Lyme in the United States. There's 300 strains in the world, and the Western blots from local labs, Quest, LabCorp, BioReference, they only pick up one strain. So you can't expect these tests are going to pick it up. So what I tell patients is if you have this multisystemic illness, as I described, and you do a Western blot and it shows any one of five bands, these are proteins from Borrelia burgdorferi, the organism that causes Lyme. If any one of these five numbers or bands shows up on a Western blot, bingo, it means you've been exposed to Lyme. And that is the 23, the 31, the 34, the 39, and the 83-93 bands. So it's kind of like you can ask your doctor for a copy of your Western blot, and if you've got these symptoms coming and going, and any of these numbers, these bands are on your Western blot, it means you've been exposed to Lyme disease.
So how come, okay, so you're the expert, and you've just told us a whole bunch of stuff that makes us all very nervous. In other words, this is going to be very hard to figure out what's going on. You're the cure. That's why they call you a doctor. What do you do?
Well, it's not really that difficult to figure out because if you're tired and have headaches and have memory problems and your doctor has ruled you out for other diseases, you need to know that Lyme is the number one worldwide spreading epidemic and it mimics all these different diseases. So if you've been diagnosed, for example, with chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia or multiple sclerosis or an autoimmune disease like rheumatoid arthritis, if you have what would be described as early Alzheimer's, bad memory problems that no one can tell you why, Even ALS. We're seeing ALS patients come in who've all tested positive. You need to know that in this worldwide epidemic of tick-borne diseases, that it can mimic all these other diseases. So your doctor has to do a differential diagnosis. And what I've done in my book, Why Can't I Get Better, is in the middle of the book, around page 70, 75, I have tables that describe to you that if you have a headache, that doesn't mean you have Lyme. It could mean your blood sugars are low, you have a food sensitivity, or you have migraines, or you're not getting to sleep. But you want to do a differential diagnosis to make sure that all of the other causes are ruled out. And really, the point of my book is that I'm finding that these people who are chronically ill now, and it's important to look at chronic illness because 75% of our healthcare costs now in the United States are due to chronic illness. 70% of the deaths in the United States are from chronic disease, and we don't have a model for chronic disease. And what I've discovered, seeing 12,000 chronically ill people, is the model that's described in my book, it's a 16-point model, is multifactorial. It says to you that if you go into your doctor and you have pain in your foot, and the doctor looks for, you know, why you have pain, he may only find one of the nails in your foot. This model is multifactorial. You may have four reasons or six reasons or eight reasons why you have pain.
No, I get this all, Dr. Horowitz, but what I don't get is what you do once you see this multifactorial presentation, what you do in order to cure the patient.
Okay, so what I would do is first I would do a history and physical, get the chief complaints, and take a good detailed history. So for example, you want to know if someone is tired. Have they had hormone problems? Are their thyroids low? Do they have adrenal problems?
Okay, so rule it all out.
First, you rule out other things that cause headaches, that cause fatigue, that cause pain. Once you've ruled this out, and you can do this by blood tests, you'll check people for autoimmune diseases like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, rule them out for food sensitivities, check their hormones. Once you've ruled them out for other causes, and again, I find that it's never one thing. It's never just Lyme when people are sick who see me. Most of the people who see me who are sick have Lyme. They have associated co-infections like Babesia. So if they have day sweats...
Well, let's just stop there for a minute. Babesia is?
It's a malaria-type illness. It's a parasite, which is now in the ticks. And it's spreading very rapidly.
So the same tick that has the Lyme has the Babesia.
Correct. Yeah. So it causes malaria-type symptoms. So if you're someone who has day sweats, night sweats, chills, air hunger where you can't catch your breath, a cough you can't explain, that could be Babesia. If, you, again, you've ruled out other causes of these sweats. I find that Babesia and Bartonella, which is cat scratch fever, which is also in the ticks, are causing a lot of these people to be ill.
Let's stop there for a moment and ask you about the cat scratch fever.
Right. So the
why is it called that?
Well, Bartonella is a type of a bacteria.
Yeah.
And probably what happened is the ticks picked it up from cats and they transmit it now to humans. And there's many species of Bartonella. So again, what I'm finding is there
is
are these...
True, but is it true that when the cat scratches you, that gives you the disease?
Correct. You can also get Bartonella from a cat scratch. That's correct. But if you just get it from a cat, you might just get a swollen lymph node. You might feel a little tired. You might get a fever. But you're not going to get the same clinical symptoms you do when you get Lyme with Bartonella, with Babesia, with hormone problems, with a sleep disorder. The problem I find is that, you know, when we go to medical school, doctors are taught pastor's postulate. There's one cause for one disease. So right now with Lyme disease, the reason we have this problem is people think when they get Lyme and they don't get better, you're asking about a cure. Well, the reason they don't cure Lyme disease with what people are doing is it's not just Lyme disease.
Okay, Dr. Horowitz, here's the question. Somebody comes to see you in your practice at Hyde Park and walks in and says, okay, I feel like garbage. I don't feel good. I'm going to go to the guy who can cure me. Now, you've told us all of the reasons we have to be very careful here, co-infections and everything else. How do you cure people?
Well, the fact is I don't know that I have a cure. I mean, this is, in fact, one of the problems that we're grappling with in medicine right now, which is that there are two standards of care for Lyme disease. And I think this is why the doctors are confused. The Infectious Disease Society of America, infectious disease doctors, have their set of guidelines that say that Lyme is easily diagnosed and easily cured. They believe that 30 days of antibiotics will cure you.
And sometimes it does, right?
Sometimes it does if you catch it early. And this is the reason, by the way, why you really want early prevention. So the point is that if you go to a doctor who's treated you with 30 days of antibiotics, you can cure it if you catch it early.
But can you cure the whole spectrum?
Well, if you have Babesia, for example, you're not going to cure that with 30 days of antibiotics for Lyme. It's treated differently. Well, that you would need to treat with anti-malarial type medicines like Mepron and Zithromax or clindamycin. You have to use different medicines to treat Babesia.
Sure.
The problem I find with Babesia, this parasite, is that also I have people who have chronic persistent babesia when it's not been treated early and found early on.
Right.
Same thing with Bartonella cat scratch fever. Same thing with mycoplasma, another bacteria that's in people. So I'm finding these multiple infections in people, and that's not really addressed in the guidelines that the infectious disease doctors are talking about.
Well, is the medical establishment unhappy with you for saying all this?
Well, I think right now there are controversies, and definitely Lyme has become a political disease, not just a medical disease.
What do you mean?
I mean that what's happened is that the CDC, when they first came out, and the Department of Health came out with the guidelines for how you diagnose Lyme, they basically said that when you use an ELISA, followed by a Western blot, the testing scheme.
ELISA is the number one test that everybody gets,
correct.
Right? Okay, and you say, hey, only picks up 50%, it doesn't work, and then they get the Western blot. And the Western blot itself doesn't pick up all of the co-infections, and we have that problem. So what happens now?
Well, the health department's basically said that you're going to use this testing scheme for basically proving epidemiologically who really has Lyme. They wanted to make sure then that when they looked at the studies, they're getting people who have Lyme and don't have other diseases. The problem is it was really just for health departments to screen patients. It was never supposed to be used for doctors in clinical practice to use these guidelines. And unfortunately, what's happened is the insurance companies have adopted these guidelines and basically told doctors, don't treat for more than 30 days.
And we won't pay you if you do.
We won't pay you if you do or give the doctors a hard time, meaning you might be thrown out of the insurance companies if you don't follow the insurance company guidelines.
Okay, but I must say, I must confess to a certain amount of frustration with what you're saying, and that is because everybody who is listening right now is listening because you are the Lyme doctor, and so I wanted to ask you this. Do you get a lot of patients who are just experiencing the first symptoms of what they think are Lyme, or do you get some of the real tough ones?
No, the vast majority of the people who come to see me are the ones who are chronically ill, who show up in wheelchairs, who have lost their vision, who've had MS-type presentations where they can't walk because half their body is numb and tingling and weak. I get the worst of the worst. I get the ones who've seen 10 to 20 doctors. They don't have any answers. They come to see me, and I do get the vast majority of the patients better, not cured, but the vast majority get better following the 16-point model that I've discovered.
Are they willing to listen to you, or are you too complicated for them?
No, they listen to me. I don't really have problems with compliance with my patients because they've been sick for so long and they've taken a long time to get into my practice. They do listen to me, and fortunately, as I said, the vast majority do improve with the treatment. But really, the issue here is, for example, the woman in a wheelchair who came in 6 years and cost New York State over $500,000 in disability payments, it was babesia. It was this parasite that kept her in a wheelchair. She started walking after we treated her babesia.
And how did you treat it?
We treated it with anti-malarial type drugs called Mepron and Zithromax. And she, after within 10 days, she had enough strength to start getting out of the wheelchair. And right now, she's still walking.
How much of all of this is emotional? I mean, you know, we know that some diseases which are hard to identify are, well, frankly, for want of a better word, from the brain.
There is an emotional component. Definitely the mind, body, spirit, it all works together. You can't separate it out. And unfortunately with Lyme, what's happened is these people have been to 10 to 20 doctors and told it's all in their head. So a lot of these people have post-traumatic stress because they've been told there's nothing wrong with them, and yet they feel so sick. Many people have had abuse and had problems in their lives, and it definitely affects their immune system. But I would not say it's the primary reason why they're sick, but it's one of those nails in their foot as to why they don't get better, that they sometimes do have to deal with the emotional consequences of having a long-term chronic illness. The way you get better from this disease is, first of all, to figure out this model that I'm using is called MSIDS, Multiple Systemic Infectious Disease Syndrome. And I've developed this model after seeing 12,000 people. And what I discovered is that you can have multiple things wrong with you at the same time. So, for example, for some people, it might be their hormones are too low. The doctor may not have checked them for adrenal problems. The adrenal function was low, and if the adrenals aren't working, your immune system doesn't fight the disease. Or you might be a man in your 20s or 30s, you have low testosterone from the Lyme disease, which affected your hormones. The reason you're tired and your libido's low is the doctor never bothered to check that. But also,
libido being low, meaning you don't want to do sex.
Correct. You don't want to have sex. You're 20 years old, and you just don't feel like the desire to have sex. And that's very unusual in a 20 or 30 year old. And I'm finding that men who come to me have low testosterone levels, some of them, when they've been exposed to Lyme.
And they have low testosterone levels as a result of the Lyme or the associated diseases?
Yes, as a result of the Lyme affecting the pituitary gland, the master hormone gland in the body. So if you have low hormones and then you get environmental toxins like mercury or lead or mold, we're starting to find mold toxins showing up in people. and your body can't get rid of these toxins. Unfortunately, these toxins cause the same symptoms as Lyme. If you look at mercury, mercury causes fatigue, it causes pain, it causes psychiatric symptoms, it causes memory problems. So the problem is there are these overlapping factors on this MCIDS model. You have to, as a medical detective, figure out how many of these factors are present in someone at the same point. Do they have Lyme? Do they have co-infections like babesia? Do they have heavy metals? Maybe they don't detoxify. Maybe they have food sensitivities that they're sensitive to. We found that a lot of people now have what's called leaky gut. They're sensitive to some of the foods they're eating. That can make you tired. That can give you joint pain. That could give you headaches. So that doesn't mean it was Lyme, but that might be one of the factors that's keeping you sick.
So you've seen 12,000 people. How many of them have you cured?
Well, cure, you know, I don't think I've cured very many people in this model. I mean, certainly if you asked me, have people come to me and said, Doc, I feel 100% better. Are there some people who've said that? Absolutely. Are there some who say, I'm much, much better? Yes. Some who say, I'm moderately better? Yes. Some who say, I'm only a little bit better? Yes. And some who say, maybe 5, 6, 7%, that no matter what I've done, I cannot get them better? I would say that's accurate because I do my best, and there's still some things we just don't understand about this disease, like why is the immune system sometimes overstimulated, creating these inflammatory molecules, making them tired and achy and giving you memory problems? I don't know how to shut off the immune system that's overstimulated in some of these people. No one does, which is why we need good research. It's why we need all the doctors to come together and work together for the benefit of these people who are suffering.
So how come all the doctors aren't coming together and working together?
Well, you know, I think medicine, from the history of medicine, there's always been doctors that have been debating one side or the other. I mean, this goes back from hundreds
of
years
ago. But some of them run the NIH and others don't.
Correct. Okay. And the NIH...
Or the New York State Department of Health.
Correct. And the NIH right now is doing studies to try and figure out why people are chronically ill. But I think where we have a failure of our healthcare policy at this point is that Lyme's been out for 35 years.
These people, I can believe.
Well, that we, since we've discovered, it's been out for thousands, but we've discovered it, let's say 35, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And we've been looking for answers. These people are as sick as people with chronic congestive heart failure. They're disabled. In fact, 22% of New Yorkers, I don't know if you know this figure, are disabled in New York State right now. This is from the New York State Department of Health.
What do you mean disabled?
22% of New Yorkers, if you look on the New York State Department of Health website,
are in one way or the other
disabled. Now, here's the question. Why are they disabled? Why are there so many people? Why do over 3 million people have arthritis? And why are some of them young? I mean, it could be Lyme. It could be co-infections. So the problem is the NIH is studying it, and they just did a study. It's called a xenodiagnostic study. They took people who had Lyme. They call it post-treatment Lyme disease. I call it Lyme MCIDS. They took these people who are still sick. They took ticks who don't have any Lyme in them, put these ticks on these people and said, can we find the DNA of Lyme months or years later? And the answer is they did. Now, they were not willing to come out in their study and say that it's persistent. What they said is, we found the DNA, but we don't know the meaning of this. Well, here's the problem. If you get hepatitis B or C and you get DNA in your blood 6 months or 12 months later, they're going to tell you you have chronic hepatitis B or C. You're not normally supposed to have dead DNA running around in your body 6 to 12 months later. But politically, because of the fact that they've got these double-blind placebo-controlled studies that were done where people didn't get better with antibiotics, they're basically saying, we don't know why you're sick. I'm saying, I know in good part why you're sick, because I've seen 12,000 chronically ill people, and we need to work together. We need to get the CDC and the NIH in a forum with the insurance companies, with ILADS doctors, with IDSA doctors, with researchers, scientists. Everyone needs to come to the table because this is the number one worldwide spreading epidemic. And for us to be debating it this way back and forth while people are suffering makes no sense. We need compassion. We need open-mindedness, and we need good communication. And that is just not happening right now.
Now, Dr. Horowitz, are you telling me that doctors who take your approach, which is a multifaceted, multi-system approach, are at some risk with the authorities?
That is correct. What's happened is, across the United States, just not in New York, doctors who have treated Lyme disease with chronic antibiotics have had their license taken away from them.
What do you mean with chronic antibiotics?
Meaning you can have acne with zits, and it's okay to give 2 years of doxycycline. That is perfectly fine. But if you have chronic Lyme or Lyme MCIDS, as I'm describing it, and you give 2 years of antibiotics, your license could be taken away in New York State and other states.
Has it been in some cases?
It has been in some cases. Doctors have lost their license across the United States, not just New York, across the U.S., for treating with long-term antibiotics because, and this is the political problem, because the CDC and the NIH has aligned themselves with the IDSA, with the infectious disease doctors. And the problem is, these same doctors are saying, we don't know why these people are sick. And that's a problem, because when you've got people who become disabled from this disease, and it's now 35 years later, and the disability rates, as I said, in New York State are 22%, you need to look and see whether some of the answers that I've discovered need to be validated, well, and that's what I'd like them to do.
Let's be clear, when you say 22%, which is a humongous figure, are disabled, that by no means should anybody listening to this program who's come in later any other time think that the 22% are all because of Lyme disease.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, okay. But there are reasons not to treat with extended antibiotics. I mean, every day you pick up a health prevention magazine, something, it's going to tell you, we've antibiotic'd ourselves out to the point now where various strains of, you know, of bacteria are killing us, and therefore you shouldn't take too much antibiotic.
You're absolutely correct, except the problem is that 70% of the antibiotics that most people have taken in has been from animal feed, not from what doctors are giving them. That's number one. Number two, they are worried about
animal feed. Let's go into that for a second.
The animals have been fed antibiotics, chickens and cows. They've been given antibiotics to try and prevent diseases. So a lot of the antibiotics that people ingest are not from doctors. 70% has been shown to be from what we ingest in our food supply. So that's number one. And in Europe, by the way, they don't allow this to happen.
Do they do there?
They don't give, because I'm in France quite a bit. They don't give the animals antibiotics in France. They have more natural methods of farming. The other part of it with the antibiotics is, you're absolutely right, you have to be careful. Antibiotics can cause diarrhea, like Clostridium difficile, which is a bad form of diarrhea. It can cause yeast problems. The way I avoid it is I give billions and billions of healthy probiotics.
What's a probiotic?
A probiotic is Acidophilus. It's what's found in yogurt. And we now know that if you take these different strains of these good bacteria, you can prevent antibiotic-associated diarrhea. And unfortunately, even in the hospitals, when they give them large doses of antibiotics, it is not standard medical practice to give people Acidophilus in the hospital, Saccharomyces boulardii. It's a healthy yeast. It's been shown to stop C. diff diarrhea. It's not part of standard medical practice. So there are ways of stopping the side effects of antibiotics. You just have to know how to give the proper probiotics, do blood tests to make sure it's not affecting the liver and the kidneys, which it generally does not. And generally, people stay safe. But, you know, we have other diseases where you have to treat with long-term antibiotics. Tuberculosis, infections of the bone called osteomyelitis, certain tick-borne infections like Q fever, where you get an infection of the heart valve called endocarditis. It's years of antibiotics. So treating with years or months of antibiotics for Lyme, it would not be the first time in the history of medicine that we know disease has to be treated long-term. Now, what I do to get people off antibiotics is the moment that they're improving, I get them off and get them on more natural regimens.
Like?
There are some herbal products like cat's claw, cimento, banderol, traditional Chinese herbs. I've looked into these natural regimens in the last 26, 27 years, and I found that about 70% of the patients who see me do get better with these natural herbal protocols.
Now, isn't this the kind of thing that can get you in trouble with the authorities, like the folks up in Washington and New York State, the authorities, by saying, well, because the drug enforcement people don't study these remedies that you're talking about?
Well, actually, they have been published. Interestingly enough, they've been published in the scientific literature.
Right.
For example, cimento and banderol, it's been published. Cimento, there's loads of references. Stephen Buda wrote a book on Lyme disease. But
they haven't gone through all the, as you said before, double-blind and everything else.
No, I mean, that's true. Double-blind studies have not been done. But as far as the pharmacopoeia of looking at the side effects of these and studying their safety and efficacy, look, you can get these off the internet. These are things that are available that people just buy on the internet.
You get a lot of things off the internet.
Well, yes. But the point is, I think they regulate it to a point, but I have not seen bad side effects from people taking these herbs. So in other words, I've studied them over the years to find which ones are safe.
Yeah, but you're one person, and that's anecdotal. It's not
correct.
It's not widespread study. I want to point out that we're talking with Dr. Richard Horowitz. We're delighted he's with us today, medical director of the Hudson Valley Healing Arts Center and author of Why Can't I Get Better? Solving the Mystery of Lyme and Chronic Disease. Okay, Richard Horowitz, Tell me this. Are you a pessimist or an optimist?
I'm generally an optimist.
But I'm sitting here somewhat depressed because I'm hearing that, you know, there are so many variables here. There are so many co-infections. Your book, Why Can't I Get Better, indicates that people aren't getting better. You saw 12,000 patients, and even you say, well, you know, I don't really know how many of them got better.
Well, it's not that these patients have not gotten better with my treatment. They have gotten better. I just said that I didn't necessarily cure them.
Okay.
So there's a difference between improving
yes.
the quality of lives, getting their fatigue better, their headaches better, their joint pain. That I can do in the vast majority of people. Over 90%, I will get better. But I'm just saying I don't cure them because I do see people relapse. When they stop the antibiotics, the vast majority who've had this for years relapse with the symptoms that come back. If the herbs are working for them, some of the natural remedies, and they stop those, the vast majority, the symptoms will come back. There's no doubt in my mind these are chronic, persistent infections.
So let me ask you something. When I was a kid, they used to come around and spray for mosquitoes on Fire Island where I grew up. Is there something we can be doing the same way with ticks?
Well, I mean, that's what they're looking at right now. For example, there's a type of a fungus that will kill about 70% of the ticks, so we need to look at maybe spraying that. They're now
what
looking...
else will it kill is the question.
Well, that's a good question, but yeah. This came out of Connecticut that looks promising. And there were some recent studies looking at immunizing actually the mice. So if ticks would feed off the mouse, it would destroy the spirochetes inside the mouse.
Yeah, they've been doing that with rabies by feeding the raccoons.
So they're looking at these different methods. And I think that, you know, on a global scale, when you look at the number one worldwide spreading vector-borne epidemic, we do need to look at these type of methods of keeping down the tick population.
So are the doctors who are following the protocols that are established, which is 2 weeks of heavy antibiotic, are they doing the wrong thing?
In my opinion, a doctor has the right to be able to follow the two sets of guidelines, either the IDSA guidelines or ILEDs. They have the right.
Let's go back to those two. Yeah. What are they again?
There are two groups now. There are two sets of guidelines on how you diagnose and treat Lyme disease and tick-borne disorders. One is by the infectious disease doctors, called the IDSA, the Infectious Disease Society of America. The other is by ILADS, the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society. And I was one of the founding members of ILADS.
And how different are these two?
They're completely different. They're diametrically opposed.
How so?
The IDSA says, easy to diagnose, easy to treat. ILADS says, no, patients need an individualized approach. You can't do cookbook medicine and just apply guidelines. As I've said, I found up to 16 reasons why these people are sick. You have to apply the guidelines and do individualized medicine using differential diagnosis. The tests are definitely not reliable. That I know for sure. And you can't cure this disease if you have it for months and you haven't gotten it early on. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind about this. It's just politically, unfortunately, they're relying upon these double-blind studies. But the problem with the double-blind studies is two out of those four double-blind studies showed that people did get better. The Krupp study, the fatigue got better. And Brian Fallon's study from Columbia University at the NIH, they also got better. Their brain function got better. Fatigue, joint pain. It's just it didn't remain better because they stopped the antibiotics. So it's not that people didn't get help from the double-blind studies. They're just being interpreted in a certain way. The healthcare system, from where I'm standing, we're about, I believe, from the last studies I looked at, 16% of our healthcare costs are right now healthcare for the United States and for our global economy. And in about 30 years, it's going to be about a third of the money we're going to spend in the United States on healthcare. We can't support that. So we need to find answers for chronic disease. And I think a multifactorial model, what I've seen in these patients, is something that has to be studied by the CDC, by the NIH. It needs to be validated, and it needs to be validated now. We're running out of time.
Well, now, all the great scientists in history, all the great doctors have run up against what you're running up against, the old graybeards who have basically said, no, you can't do it this way, and given them a hard time. And some of them have risked going to jail.
Well, I'm not sure you go to jail from this, but I think, do you risk your medical license for standing up for people who are suffering? I think, as I said, the way I was trained, my job as a doctor with the Hippocratic Oath is patients come first, not insurance companies. If insurance companies, like I was thrown out of two insurance companies years ago because I discovered Babesia, I was the first doctor to discover Babesia in the Hudson Valley. I was told by two insurance companies Babesia did not exist, and after I spent their money on drugs for Babesia, I was thrown out saying the disease didn't exist. Well, at that point, we knew, because I sent out the ticks myself from the Carey Institute with Rick Osfeld, 3 to 4% of the ticks had Babesia. Now, 13, 15 years later, over 40% of the ticks have Babesia, and it's gotten into the blood supply, and it's deadly. So by them not listening, well, it's spread now.
Have they come back to you and said, Rich, we apologize?
No, I've not yet gotten an apology from the insurance companies at this point.
Do you keep sending them material and saying, look, here's the proof, here's what we got?
I have sent insurance companies multiple times proof of how bad the blood tests are and Lyme persisting. There's loads of scientific documents showing this. I have never gotten back an answer at this point from the insurance company saying, thank you, Dr. Horowitz, for your concern for these sick and suffering people. We're going to take it seriously, or meet with us and let's have a forum to discuss how we can improve the diagnosis and treatment. That's
because
what needs to take
place. Because it's all about money, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it is about money. And unfortunately, what's not really being looked at right now is what happens when you go to 10 to 20 doctors looking, because this is what happens to the people who come to
see me.
People
shop around.
They shop around. They have headaches. They're tired. They have joint pain. They can't get better. They spend a lot of our healthcare dollars trying to figure out why they're sick. I think what's sad here is that, again, when I was saying that 75% of our healthcare costs are chronic disease, and it's going to break our system in 30 years, if the insurance companies realize we could do a better job with prevention, including prevention of tick-borne disorders, prevention in all ways, this could really decrease our healthcare costs or open up chronic disease centers of excellence where people use the model the way I'm describing. Since the model you're using right now for chronic disease doesn't work, Alzheimer's disease right now is spreading across the United States. It's going to triple in the next 30 years, and it's going to break our healthcare bank, and we don't know what causes Alzheimer's, but we do know that they found Lyme disease in the brains of people at the NIH data bank. We know that inflammation is the reason you get Alzheimer's. And they've even found in Mexico cities in children that died at 13, 14 years old.
The reason you get Alzheimer's is because of the plaque.
Well, it is the plaque, but it's due to inflammation.
And the plaque is due to inflammation.
But what they don't know is what are the multiple reasons you have inflammation. So the model that I'm describing, a 16-point model, 8 points out of the 16 cause inflammation. Well, what if it was that people have multiple infections, even starting early on in life, environmental pollutants that cause inflammation in Mexico City, kids that died, they found early Alzheimer-type changes in their brains in Mexico City at 13 years old. Now, that's not from Lyme. That's from environmental pollutants causing inflammation. So we need to address chronic infections, pollution, and that is not being addressed in a present healthcare model. And I think that's one of the places we really need to be looking at in a chronic disease model in the future.
So right now, you have these complaints about the way in which we're treating Lyme, and we're not going in the right direction, right?
That is correct. I mean, I think what needs to take place, because we're in the middle of an epidemic and I've seen so many people who have suffered for so long going from doctor to doctor without answers, we need a forum. We need to get together. New York State politicians need to do this with infectious disease doctors, ILADS doctors, get the insurance companies. We all need to get together and communicate in a forum. Let's look at the science together. Let's get beyond the politics and treat people who are sick and suffering and get back to what medicine is supposed to be about.
Richard, let's go to the politics. What do you mean by the politics?
Right now, unfortunately, as I said, the health departments and the CDC have taken sides in a debate. They've basically said that we're going to follow the infectious disease guidelines, even though there are two guidelines out there. The ILADS guidelines were published on the National Guidelines Clearinghouse. It's one of two guidelines for how you can treat. There are
two
standards of care.
That's your group.
Right. But the thing is the CDC recently did a study and showed that over half of the doctors in the United States treat according to my group. They showed that over 50% of the doctors in the U.S. treat according to ILADS guidelines, not IDSA.
Again, ILADS is?
The International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society.
Okay, so these are the docs who are practicing this.
These are the docs who are saying Lyme is not easily diagnosed and cured. Co-infections are playing a role in keeping people sick.
And the other group are the infectious doctors. Who are they? What are they called?
The Infectious Disease Society of America, the IDSA. And I'll point out, Alan, I have ID doctors who are friends of mine. They don't follow the IDSA guidelines either. It's not that everyone follows all the guidelines. Doctors have a right to choose individually for their patients.
Okay. How would you stop the present political stalemate that we're looking at? In other words, do you go to your state senator, United States senator? You go to Chuck Schumer or Kirsten Gillibrand? Who is in a position to help mediate this issue between these groups?
I think you've got to do it at the level of, yes, of the New York State, of going to Schumer, going to Gillibrand, going to the people who have
an
interest.
Do that?
I've started to reach out to the politicians at this point and explain to them what's going on right now. I think it also needs to be done at a national level because healthcare obviously is on everyone's mind at this point in the United States and our economy and disability. So I think, yes, you should do it at a state level. And I think what I'm suggesting is a forum. I suggest that both sides present the scientific data of what they've seen, because right now they're not listening to us, those docs who are in the trenches, who are treating people who are chronically ill, who are having successful results, as I said, not necessarily cured, but getting these people better. We are having results, but no one is communicating with us and asking us why we're getting them better or how we're getting them better.
So is the National Institutes of Health always by nature, because it takes time to change, are they always reactionary?
You know, I certainly don't know them well enough to know how reactionary. I know.
Well, I'm talking about over time. I mean, I'm thinking about doctors who've gotten into trouble because they refuse to follow guidelines, or they on silver nitrite in the baby's eyes when they're born, and they get into terrible trouble on that. I'm just, because, you know, there's a standard way of doing it, and then when somebody new comes along and says, look, this is a different approach, which we need to take, they're considered to be adventurous.
Well, I mean, I think the thing here is there is science backing up the approach that I'm telling you about today. In fact, lots of it. And the problem really politically, and this is why I think you've got to get the insurance companies, the politicians,
well,
everyone.
You said that.
Yeah.
But where is all of the evidence published?
Oh, it's published in peer-reviewed medical journals. It's just the problem is the average doctor hasn't taken the time to be able to look through these medical journals and to see what the literature is saying. But it's out there in published peer-reviewed medical literature.
Now, you're an expert in integrative medicine. You have a practice which does that. Some people look askance on that. How do you deal with, on the one hand, having an integrative medicine practice, and on the other, you know, in which you use some non-traditional herbs and things of that kind, and on the other, you know, things like, I'm going to put them on antibiotics till they get better. Does that confuse the issue?
Not really, because I'm a board-certified internist, and I learned when I got out of medical school that I have to be a detective and figure out with good science what's out there. So the integrative model right now, there's a lot of good science backing it up. In fact, for example, it's nutritional biochemistry. I mean, a lot of doctors, for example, don't look to see if people are nutritionally deficient in zinc, let's say, or in iodine, or in copper. Well, these have big effects on the body. Now, we learned it in medical school. It's just you didn't apply it in your clinical practice. Or you might not have learned that the type of bacteria in your colon are causing inflammation. Or the food you're eating, you might have learned you can, you know, eat peanuts and get a food allergy and die, but you might not have learned that you can get food sensitivities that will cause headaches, joint pain, and fatigue if you didn't go into the integrative literature. And the thing is, also the integrative literature, which is, again, good published peer-reviewed science, this is what I'm relying upon when I'm doing this in my practice. So I'm relying still on peer-reviewed science. It's been published in the integrative literature.
But not on things like the herbs and other things that have not been tested by the federal government.
Well, no. I mean, they've been published in peer-reviewed literature as far as safety and efficacy for certain things. If you're asking, have they been studied in trials, like having
exactly.
A patient with chronic... No, that is not... That is actually one of the things I would like to do with the NIH and CDC, is saying, look, I've seen 12,000 people. I get the majority of them better. Please take my model and validate it. And let's look at it from a strict scientific basis, because we don't have time. We really are running out of time here with the kind of suffering that I'm seeing and healthcare costs, which are spiraling at this point, that we're going to go broke in the healthcare system in 35 years from chronic disease.
Now is the FDA allowed to do these trials on herbs and other alternative remedies?
I don't think it's the FDA. I think it's more the Office of Alternative Medicine of the NIH. I mean, the NIH, and what's interesting is, I mean, Harvard and Duke University and the University of Arizona, there are many places, medical schools in the United States now teaching integrative medicine.
Sure.
So really what it comes down to is that they've got to do the clinical trials, and the best place would be the Office of Alternative Medicine through the NIH. So it should be done through them.
But I was asking a specific question because I remember there was quite a to-do over whether or not the government should be studying alternative medicines that are on the market. I mean, I had a friend, long gone now, by the way, who used to go down to Chinatown and get ground up chicken feet, swearing that this was what the Chinese used and it worked. So, I mean, I think it's important, even the medicines that have been studied to death turn out 10 years later to have issues.
No, you're absolutely correct. But the reason doctors need to learn integrative medicine is there's billions of dollars being spent by patients right now doing it. So if your patient is doing integrative procedures or taking supplements and you don't know what these supplements do to the body, you as a doctor basically then are not well educated because your patients are out. Two-thirds of Americans right now are using complementary medicine.
Two-thirds of Americans are using complementary medicine?
That is correct.
Well, what do you mean?
They may be going to a chiropractor or a massage therapist.
Oh, I see.
Or they may be going to the health food stores and using different types of vitamins. But it's billions and billions of dollars being
sure.
spent at this point in the United States.
But those industries quite frequently are working at cross purposes with organized medicine for one reason or another. I mean, I've always thought, for example, boy, am I going to get into trouble for this? The chiropractors, they're not allowed to prescribe, right? And it's all about prescription. So they don't sell medicine. They're not allowed to, you know, certified medicine. So they sell, you know, fish oil or something like it so that it's the, I mean, am I wrong about that?
Well, no, but I mean, the chiropractors, for example, that I know, some of them have been quite excellent at doing the initial differential diagnosis.
Well,
for
it's the sum of them.
Right, of course. I mean, the patients, though, come in, though, with neck pain and headaches and joint pain. And I know many good chiropractors, for example, who made the diagnosis of Lyme and then refer to, for example, an internist like myself or someone else to treat.
Right. But if they want a buck, better to, because I've been to see chiropractors, too, better to treat themselves than to send patients in every case to another doctor.
I mean, I can't speak for what people do. Everyone has their own morality and ethics of how they practice.
Well, but no, but there's the way that we've organized our practices are that if we have a chiropractor, and you know, all of us who have been to chiropractors, that on the way out, they're going to say, by the way, take this, this, and this, maybe the probiotics that you're talking about or something else, and hand you this stuff and make some more money, because they're not allowed to do what you do, which is to put somebody on antibiotics.
Right. Well, I think a lot of them that I know are definitely interested in prevention with nutrition and prevention, as you said, probiotics and the rest.
But you don't suspect, come on now, Richard, you don't suspect that some of it has to do with making your dollar?
The almighty buck always has something to do the way people are practicing. That's not even an issue. But still beyond that, you still have the morality and ethics of doing the right thing for people, and I think you can still do that.
You are an optimist.
I am an optimist. And I do think, by
the hand, I'm not.
No, I do think, by the way, that we are going to find a solution for this. I think we have no choice, quite truthfully, because no matter what the politics are right now, this disease is just going to keep spreading. People are going to get sicker. It's going to cost the healthcare system billions.
And as more people get sick, and as this becomes more of an epidemic, does that put pressure from Lyme or associated diseases? Does that put more pressure on government and doctors and the medical establishment to come around to your way of thinking?
I think it does, because even if they don't have the level of compassion of, wow, these people are sick and suffering, eventually the almighty dollar will force them to look at my model, because if 75% of healthcare costs are due to chronic disease, and you don't have a chronic disease model right now for, you know, autism, 1 in 88 people are getting it. Cancer, you've got a 40% chance as a man or woman in the United States of getting some form of cancer in your lifetime.
What did you say the percentage was?
40% is the prevalence of cancer of men and women in the United States. Or Alzheimer's, the rates are tripling. We don't have answers for these diseases. So it's going to break the healthcare bank. They're going to be forced to say, Dr. Horowitz has a 16-point model for chronic disease. Let's study it. But I'm just asking them, study it now, please, before the epidemic gets worse. And because
well, you know, that's not going to happen. You know that, as you just suggested, it is going to be after it gets worse.
Well, I'm hoping, this is the optimist part of me, that someone will listen to this show and will say, wow, this makes sense. Let's get that form together. Let's look at the science of what Dr. Horowitz is talking about of the diagnosis and treatment, and let's look at that model, because there's no reason really that they can't take some of our healthcare dollars and look at the model that I know is working for people. There's no reason that someone at a governmental level can't take the healthcare dollars and study it.
Now, you're the Lyme disease guy. Let's go over what we learned in the beginning. First of all, prevention. I'm just Joe Schmo. I got an acre of land. I love going out in the blueberries and the hollyhocks and doing all that stuff. What should somebody who's about to garden do?
First of all, light-colored clothing. You can
light-colored
clothing, because you can see the ticks. Oh, you can see them easier.
Can they get through the clothing to your skin?
They won't get through the clothing, but they'll find places, of course, where you don't have the clothing. They'll keep a tick can go, by the way, from your foot to your head in like 1 to 2 minutes. That's
really?
That's how fast they are. The Lone Star tick, which is another type of tick.
From Texas?
But we've got it now in New York, too. It'll smell you from 50 feet away, your body temperature, your heat, and it'll come running towards you. They're much more aggressive even than some of the other ticks. So you've got to wear light clothing, spray it with permethrin spray to repel the ticks.
Let's go over all of this, because I think people are listening and they're going to be very interested in this. Spray it with permethrin. And how do you spell that?
P-E-R-M-E-T-H-R-I-N, permethrin. Okay.
And you spray your clothing with it?
You take it outside, take your clothes outside, spray the clothes. It's good for 1 or 2 weeks. Yeah. That will help repel the ticks. Then you can use things like Avon Skin So Soft. There are some natural products, even DEET, if you're in a highly endemic area, to repel the ticks, and do a tick check afterwards when you come inside. And they now sell these little devices that you can carry with you to remove the ticks. because you don't want to squeeze the tick. You want to remove it from the head and pull straight up with tweezers or use one of these devices that pulls it straight up. Because if you squeeze the tick, you may squeeze these bacteria, viruses, parasites into your body.
Do you remember what the name of the device is?
Oh, there are many of them out there.
Yeah, go to a hardware store.
Yeah, they usually have
a gardening supply store. Okay, so now we got the white clothing. We've got the DEET, which has, of course, been decried by some as being in itself a health hazard. Right?
And by the way, I believe that. Mm-hmm. I don't use DEET often, but if I was saying you were going to take a walk in the woods and heavily endemic, you might want to use a DEET because they can go from several percentage to 40%. You know, use something that's lighter and immediately wipe it off. You've got to weigh out right now the fact that these ticks are containing viruses, like Powassan virus, that can kill you. So it's not just a question of just getting sick.
Yeah.
You can die from these tick-borne diseases.
So we're talking about alternative approaches here because you might want to use DEET rather than die, is your point.
Correct. I don't like DEET personally. I think it's not a great choice, and I think we should be doing research into other things to repel it. That's a great something for a pharmaceutical company.
Okay. Traps.
Right. So then you've got, for example, bait boxes, where you can put bait boxes around your property to be able to get the mice to go in there and get rid of the ticks. And there are, as I said...
Why not just kill the mice?
Well, very difficult, I mean, to control. I think what you have to do...
Kill them all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the problem is, for example, the fox population has gone down. That kills the mice.
Why? I see them all the time. Why are they gone down?
I think it's partially from coyote populations going up because the ecosystem is out of balance.
Yeah.
That's part of the problem.
Okay. So you got the bait boxes
right.
to get the mice.
You can spray your property with things like Ultra Tempo that certain tick control companies like New York Tick Control has.
They can come to your land, spray it. And how long does that last?
Well, again, they come to my property and spray twice a year in the spring and in the fall. Uh-huh. And we have not found, I would find ticks on me. I was afraid to walk out to my pond to feed the fish.
Sure.
And now we've not found ticks on us for years since they've been doing this.
What about tall grass?
You have to definitely be careful with tall grass because that's where the ticks hide.
Interesting. I knew a very prominent guy who was up there in Rensselaerville who insisted on keeping his grass really low because he had grandchildren and he didn't want them playing in the taller grass.
Yeah. It's towards the edges of the property, normally the wooded areas. That's where you've got your highest risk.
Okay. And medically, is there something that you would say that we should be taking that might help us in terms of our dealing with ticks? In other words, a preventative medicine.
Well, we don't really have anything great. I mean, basically, again, going back to these two sets of guidelines, the infectious disease doctors would say if you take one dose of doxycycline, for example, after a tick bite, that you may not get Lyme. But the problem is that study was not followed up long term. I've seen people who've taken one dose of doxy and still gotten sick, and that doesn't cover all the tick-borne infections.
And I have never asked you during this whole interview about the famous bullseye.
Right.
Is it folklore, or is it really important?
No, I mean, probably half. You know, in the Smith-Klein-Beecham studies they did years ago, between 50%, maybe a little bit more, of patients got the bullseye. The problem is half of these don't look like bullseyes. Half of the rashes
yeah.
look like solid red spreading rashes, which have been unfortunately mistaken by some physicians as a cellulitis, an infection in the skin, or a spire bite, and people are not treated appropriately. So, you know, Lyme is known as the great imitator. It imitates chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and MS and memory problems and autoimmune disorders, rheumatoid arthritis, but it also, even the rash can imitate. And this other Borrelia species I was telling you about, Borrelia miyamotoi, relapsing fever, also causes bullseye rashes. And yet the test will not be positive for Lyme disease. So even the rash can look different and not even be due always to Lyme.
So, Richard, I understand that you're also a guitar player and you wrote a song called Ballad of the Deer Tick. How did you come to do that?
My wife and I were traveling through Massachusetts. We were in a cafe and all of a sudden this started coming to me where I wrote this song. And we recorded the song with Daryl Hall from Hall & Oates and we played it in front of about 900 people in New York City several years ago at a benefit. It's got a comedic aspect to it, but it's also educational and it was a lot of fun. I mean, we did this with Daryl in a studio and we just had a ball. It was a lot of fun.
We've been talking with Dr. Richard Horowitz, medical director of the Hudson Valley Healing Arts Center and author of Why Can't I Get Better? Solving the Mystery of Lyme and Chronic Disease. Dr. Horowitz, thanks so much for the type of talk you've had with us today. We appreciate it very much.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you. I said,
Clyde, can you tell me what you did in life? You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, president and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, Call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at WAMC.org.
Gonna pick off the tick real quick before the devil gets within. Crime for the line to steal my mind. I sure could.